Welcome to The Third Degree, bringing you progressive reporting and discussion on climate change, social justice and sustainability issues.
We're a bunch of media students and environmental scientists with strong links to environmental movements. And today you're with Nick and Jess.
This week we'll look at Peter Garrett's approval of the expansion of the Beverley Uranium Mine, a decision that had protesters outside his Sydney office on Monday dressed in acid-wash jeans with cutouts of the characters from the TV show 90210, calling for toxic trash to be left in the 90s.
Also, we'll look at what's going on with the Murray-Darling, with plans currently being considered that threaten permanent ecological damage.
But first, we're joined by Erland Howden from the New South Wales Nature Conservation Council to discuss flight pollution and the practicalities of finding alternative ways to travel. Welcome to the show, Erland.
Thanks very much.
Can you tell us about the trip you're planning to take at the end of the year?
Yeah, I've got a trip planned to go to Europe, and I want to get there sustainably and with as few emissions as possible. So what's happening is I've planned a boat that's going from Melbourne to Singapore, and from there I'm going to catch trains and a couple of buses all the way up through Southeast Asia and China, across Mongolia, then across the Trans-Siberian Railway, and drop down into Europe from Moscow.
Can I ask what's led you to take this route?
Yeah, I guess I've been working on climate change issues for quite a while now, and recognising that emissions are a massive problem, and as well as advocating for change more broadly and with government, there's important personal choices that we have to make as well. And I guess I just want to be as carbon-free as possible in whatever I do. And in this instance, I've got the luxury of time, because it does take longer to travel that way.
So what exactly is sort of the environmental impact of flying and the emissions from aviation as opposed to, you know, taking the trains over to Europe?
Yeah, there's a really big difference. One of the things particularly about flights is that it's not just the fuel that you burn, but it's also about what aeroplanes actually do and the fact that they let off those emissions in the upper atmosphere. Or not the upper atmosphere, but well off the ground. So what we get is a lot of water vapour and the condensation trails, which you sometimes see from planes, and they're more prevalent, obviously, on longer and higher altitude long-haul flights. For example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is saying that for every unit of fuel that's burnt, we actually have to multiply the climate-changing effects by 2.7 times. So that's one of the areas in which flights are different to other sorts of emissions. And compared to other forms of transport, it's way more even than driving a four-wheel drive around with one person in it every day to work. An aeroplane flight can, if you do those carbon sort of calculators online and that kind of thing, they can very rapidly double your household emissions.
Do you think at the same time we're seeing the readability of cheaper flights and what seems to be a sort of a societal mind shift in how we view distance and that idea of in planning trips that it shouldn't take very long to get certain places?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. Yeah, absolutely. Flights have decreased in prices. And if you look at from when Australia has started fully accounting for all of our greenhouse emissions, emissions from the aviation sector have been the highest growth of any area of emissions. They've grown by more than 107% since 1990 to 2006 and probably even more to this year. So there's massive growth. And yes, that's absolutely right. People are expecting to be further away quicker. But there's certainly ways that we can deal with that. I mean, one thing is it's really important to think about living more locally. But there are technological solutions, and we're seeing much more usage now, especially in business, of video conferencing, telephone meetings, those kinds of things that allow us to cheaply communicate across distances without having to actually go and be there. And, you know, telecommuting that's now happening across thousands of kilometres.
Do you think there needs to be further regulation of this polluting industry? The Kyoto Protocol doesn't include international aviation as part of it. Do you think that there's room with the new green paper by the Rudd government to try and impose some kind of restrictions on aviation?
I think there are. International aviation is a tricky issue, and it's kind of one of those things that nobody counts. So it's that elephant in the room that's not accounted in any national emissions. And that certainly has to be taken into account. If we move to a second Kyoto framework, it needs to be that somehow we equitably account for where emissions are coming from, whether that's, you know, where the flight originates or where it lands or whatever. That needs to be in the accounting. It's tricky without involving other countries to try and account for our international aviation and to do that fairly, but certainly we need to take our fair share of those emissions. And we do already count our domestic emissions, and certainly more needs to be done in terms of regulation there and providing alternatives. So we certainly need much more viability of a high-speed train network around particularly the East Coast cities of Sydney, Brisbane and Melbourne, because there are a lot of flights that could quite economically be replaced if there was a decent train line in place.
I'm interested as well because I've heard basically the perspective of the aviation industry is that there are other carbon-emitting industries that basically don't get as hard a time from people for their emissions, if you know what I mean, and they're basically saying that if the government were to kind of come and step in and regulate what they do more so, you know what I mean, or a tax on top of a possible emissions trading scheme or something like this, that that's unfairly hitting them when other industries are kind of being left alone. What would be your perspective on that argument?
Sure. Certainly what we've seen in the government's ideas about their emissions trading scheme in the green paper that's come out is that they're looking at compensating and giving free emissions pollution permits to a bunch of companies and industries. And certainly we don't think that's the right way to go in terms of reducing our emissions and doing it fairly and having the money to develop alternatives and shield and implement energy efficiency and renewable energy and all those things. But that's not to say that all industries aren't going to be hit in some way. And what the government has come up with in terms of an emissions trading scheme, that scheme has the potential to basically provide the price signal that will allow the industries that can do what they want to do, provide the same services with very low emissions, to flourish. And those industries that can't, and if that includes the aviation industry, then they're going to have to either find alternatives or shut down. So it's about doing things differently. It's about finding alternatives. And there are certainly, you know, ways that they can do that. I don't think the airline industry is being unfairly disadvantaged. I read something a couple of years ago on the subsidies that actually go into and the indirect subsidies, which are difficult things to quantify, but around the world into shipping and aviation in terms of tax breaks and all that kind of thing. And they've been getting a pretty good ride for a long time.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, Erland.
No worries at all. Thanks for having me.
And this week's burning issue is uranium mining. Peter Garrett has approved the expansion of the Beverley uranium mine in South Australia. The mine has been strongly criticised over the years for using acid in situ leach techniques, banned in many countries. The Third Degree's James Hitchcock spoke with Peter Burden from Friends of the Earth Adelaide.
Peter Garrett has said his approval of the mine will ensure world-best standards of environmental management by the mine operator. Do you think this is the case?
Well, I think whenever you're using any kind of method which involves injecting heavy amounts of sulfuric acid and uranium back into groundwater systems, you've got to question what he's meaning by world's best practice. And certainly the method that will be used at Beverley is not often used anywhere else in the world. In the United States, where ISL mining does take place, they use an alkali solution, which is far, far nicer than the acid solution that we'll be using at Beverley. And further, the countries that do use this kind of method for extracting uranium are predominantly ex-Eastern Bloc countries where the standards and regulations aren't quite as strong as they are here. And further, where they are allowed to do it in other parts in the world, there's a fundamental standard that companies clean up the area and remunerate it. And this isn't being applied at Beverley, and that was certainly within Mr. Garrett's, within the flexibility of his powers to incorporate it into the mining requirements. He could have asked them to clean up the groundwater. And given record industry profits across uranium in South Australia, there's no real justifiable excuse for not requiring companies to take that basic measure.
Well, what's Heathgate's record been so far whilst managing a Beverley uranium mine?
Well, it hasn't been terribly good. I mean, since 98, they've had 59 spills. In 2002 in particular, there was a spill which contained 62,000 kilolitres of solution which leaked. and that contained 8 kilograms of uranium. In 1998, there was another significant spill, 500 litres of liquid. So they've had 59 spills in their period of holding on to the mine, and often their reporting hasn't been up to scratch either. In 2002, when they did have that significant spill of 62,000 kilolitres, it was then uncovered that they had had 22 previous spills, and this hadn't been properly reported to the South Australian or even the Australian public. And it was because the South Australian Ombudsman demanded further information, that's how come we found out about those spills.
What kind of impacts on the groundwater systems do you think this mining technique is likely to have or is having?
Well, I think the great risk is, in terms of aquifer systems, they're the least understood parts of geography that exist today. And in terms of being able to determine the extent of the aquifer, how permeable it is in all sections, those tests aren't known and can't be done. And if you're talking about groundwater systems and various layers within the ground, there's potential risks for leaking into other groundwater systems. There's potential risks for any of those sort of things. And we have seen leaks. We have seen cases where scientists have said that, you know, this aquifer will not leak, such as in the Honeymoon trial mine, and then it did leak up into other different aquifers. So this is the risk we're talking about. And it's particularly important in areas where there are connecting aquifers or there's groundwater systems surrounding the aquifer that they're putting into. Now, in Beverley, it's quite an isolated area, but you're setting precedents for other companies to do it in different locations, such as in Honeymoon, where it did leak into aquifers which farmers were drawing from, which local people draw from. But even in Beverley, there are groundwater systems nearby, and there is the potential for leaking into those systems.
Australia is currently considering exporting uranium to Russia, despite the fact that recently Russia's threatened to nuke Poland or something ridiculous. do you think nuclear proliferation is still a threat currently?
Oh, absolutely. Russia, it's funny, like when we went to Heathgate in 2008, representatives from Friends of the Earth asked them about what they thought about their uranium going to Russia and what they thought about safeguards. And they had no idea about the safeguards that were in place. And the Atomic Energy Agency, which monitors uranium in and out and non-proliferation, they are seriously underfunded. In a country like Russia, you have very big problems of access rights to see different facilities. And their facilities themselves haven't been inspected since 1994. So in terms of proliferation issues, even if our uranium doesn't directly go towards Russians' known nuclear weapons, it frees up existing uranium deposits, which they already have, or it sources from other countries, to then expand their uranium arsenal. And in terms of the checking and the ensuring that non-proliferation doesn't occur, the Atomic Energy Agency and international organisations don't have enough funding, power or say to properly control how that works.
And that was The Third Degree's James Hitchcock speaking with Peter Burton from Friends of the Earth Adelaide about the expansion of uranium mining at Beverley. Now, I don't know, I've kind of had to feel a little bit for Peter Garrett this week and everything. There are at least another 2 proposed new uranium mines on his desk awaiting approval, being Nolan's Bore, which is 135 k's north of Alice Springs, and another Plume Bargo Croker Well uranium project just west of Broken Hill. And soon, it appears he may well be asked to approve a national nuclear waste dump in the Northern Territory.
I guess what we're saying here is the follow-on from the U-turn on uranium mining at the Labor Party conference last year. And this approval, Garrett's approval, is in breach of Labor election commitments to ensure that Australian uranium mining, milling and rehabilitation is based on world best practice standards.
Mm.
And acid leach mining is not world best practice.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's the thing. Like, Garrett is apparently... we're saying Garrett's doing it, but you know what I mean. He's the environment minister. But basically, the quote can be basically allowing US nuclear giant General Atomics, which in trivia helped with the creation of the atomic bomb, but in any case, to dump hundreds of millions of litres of liquid radioactive waste into the groundwater of the Flinders Ranges.
Yeah, it's an expansion from 16 square kilometres to more than 100 square kilometres of this uranium mine. At the same time, the West Australian Labor government is about to go into the state election, and they're saying that if they are re-elected, they're going to bring in legislation that disallows any uranium mining in Western Australia. So it's sort of this contrast between state Labor policy and federal policy. And
It's difficult to imagine what's going on in his mind right now. He has said in the media, because obviously, you know, there's been articles over the last few days about this and everything, and various journalists have taken great joy in spelling out his history with Midnight Oil and quoting his lyrics and bits and pieces like that.
Are you about to do that now, Nick?
No, I'm not. But, you know, it was basically, he just said, look, I argued very strongly within the party, but, you know, it's a democratic sort of system, our party and whatever, and I basically have to, you know, fulfill my function and duty or whatever as the environment minister. This is the will of the party.
He said that personal beliefs play no part in that.
Mm.
What I find interesting is that sort of he's somehow made a separation between his personal environmental beliefs and values compared to...
And the function of the man as the minister.
Well, no, against this looking at the environmental reports. And I'm struggling to see how those two don't necessarily match up.
Mm. Well, I don't know if anybody else can remember, but just before he basically made the jump into politics and politics proper or whatever, Bob Brown said to him, look, don't go Labor. You know, they'll change you. Well.
And moving on to another story. Crisis is looming for the mouth of the Coorong wetlands and the lower lakes of the Murray River, as lack of water threatens an irreversible ecological shift. Last Wednesday, the Senate voted for an emergency inquiry to be held in order to try and save the ailing water system. A 2006 report said immediate action was necessary to save the wetland from lasting ecological damage, and recommended the site be nominated for Commonwealth protection as a critically endangered ecological area. This report was ignored by both the federal and South Australian governments. The Third Degree's Libby King spoke with Bill Phillips, former Senior Executive Officer of the Federal Environment Department and author of the report.
In mid-2006, we described the site as undergoing a significant shift in ecology, which was deeply worrying, and said that urgent attention was needed then. Otherwise, the changes that we were observing might prove irreversible.
And what urgent attention did you recommend?
Fundamentally, it comes down to providing the site with water. This is a wetland system, and this site has been deteriorating progressively for at least 30 to 40 years. Unless we get rain, unless urgent measures are taken to get water into the site, then we can say goodbye to the Coorongan Lakes. Successive reports over at least a decade have been giving warnings about the concerns and the possibilities of the current situation arising. The previous governments, federal in particular, have chosen to have their head in the sand on fate of not just this site, but also a number of other very significant wetlands across the Murray-Darling Basin. So you need to look at the Macquarie Marshes in central New South Wales and the Gwydir wetlands. And whilst we're ringing the warning bells loudest about the Coorong because the crisis is imminent, we really need to be aware that it's not restricted to just that site. And this is a reflection on how poorly we've managed water across the whole Murray-Darling Basin.
Do you think this is because of a general lack of concern on the part of people who make decisions about what's happening to these areas?
Oh, I think there are lots of reasons why this situation has come about. It's quite clear that the Murray-Darling Basin Agreement, which is being dismantled and a new structure put in place at the moment to create a more independent structure, that was long overdue. Whilst it was designed to be a cooperative arrangement, the state governments have never come to the table with a spirit of cooperation in the sense of water sharing. And the Coorong and the lake sitting at the end of the system, a headstone that we will look at in future years and say, well, yeah, the fact that that system is in the conditions it is today, it reflects the fact that governments were not willing to play the game of operating in a national interest. And there would seem to be the very real prospect that if the site is not saved, then Australia may actually be the first country to ever be forced to take a wetland of international importance off the Ramsar list, which would be a very black mark on the reputation of this country.
In terms of finding water, what do you think of the suggestion to flood the lakes with seawater?
I think it's a very sad day that we have to get to that. We would be creating a much more saline environment in the lakes than has ever been historically. It's a knee-jerk, short-term reaction and a way to deal with a crisis which may be necessary to stop major ecological collapse of the system. But I'm not sure that it's one we should rush to without very, very carefully thinking about the implications. What will happen, for example, if we replace a freshwater system with a highly saline one and that water flushes into aquifers and people who are drawing water from those aquifers will suddenly have to stop doing that? I mean, we're not just talking about a site which is internationally recognised, but we're also talking about a place which is very special culturally to the Narrangeri indigenous people of that region, but also economically to the boating and the fishing industry and to the vineyards and grazing properties and all the people who survive around this system. It's much bigger than just watching a world-listed property curling up its toes and dying.
How have the local people responded to what's happening to these wetlands?
Well, it doesn't get much coverage in Sydney or other places other than Adelaide, but there have been rallies on the steps of Parliament House. There's a series of protest actions that have been taken, and of course the people are becoming more and more agitated and concerned as the situation gets worse. I believe that the government is lagging behind community attitudes. Rural communities understand the importance of being efficient with the way they use water. They also understand that they don't want their rivers and their nearby wetlands to die. They're important parts of rural communities. And I just don't think governments are in step with the landholders of rural Australia.
And that was Libby King speaking with Bill Phillips, former Senior Executive Officer of the Federal Environment Department and author of that report. Climate change is one of those hot-button issues for the media. It's covered a lot. But amongst the public, there's still confusion about the issue. The Australian government won great support in the last election for committing to ratify the Kyoto Protocol, so people obviously feel strongly about it. But critics say that media coverage is giving disproportional airtime to climate change skeptics and thus confusing the public instead of informing them. The Third Degree's Anna von Fern spoke to Dr. Kerry Harrison, a lecturer for communications and environmental studies at the University of Southern Queensland.
One of the problems for the media is that journalists confuse balance with accuracy and objectivity. And the trouble with climate change is that equal time is given to a very small percentage of scientists, maybe 3%, given the same amount of time as the 97% majority of climate science in the way they're reported. So the voice of a small minority is given weight the same as the voice of a large majority. And that confuses the public to think they have equal weight.
But Jenny Brockie of the SBS program Inside thinks that the issue of climate change is a very difficult topic to cover.
That debate is a complicated one, and it's very difficult, actually, I think, to cover in the media because a lot of it is very complex, you know. So a lot of the debate about climate change ends up being a debate about bringing down carbon emissions, the best way to do that, and that gets into very technical territory sometimes. It can be about energy supply systems and, you know, whether we're providing our energy the right way, whether we could be doing it more efficiently, and people's eyes kind of glaze over with that sort of detail, and it makes it very difficult in the media when, you know, you're relying on getting information across to people very quickly. I think it's a very difficult debate to cover.
I asked Dr. Harrison whether the media has an important role in provoking a response to climate change.
I think it's very important because most people rely on the media as their main source of information. So if the media is not accurately representing the issue, then most people have no other source of information to correct that. Governments have a responsibility, education has a responsibility, but the media has a major role to play because no matter what those other groups are doing, confusing information is coming from the media.
TV journalist Brockie says that this is a shared responsibility by various stakeholders and not only the media.
It's very important, but I think, again, it's a shared responsibility. I think, you know, governments, oppositions, people, scientists, people working in the energy sector all have a responsibility to put forward their arguments in a responsible way. It's just like any other issue, you know, that is very important. And, of course, the media has a responsibility. I mean, we are the gateway for people to understand this stuff, and it's a challenge, I think, at some levels. When you get to the detail, it really is a challenge to kind of present it in a way that people are going to understand, absorb it, and be engaged with it.
Whilst Dr. Harrison agrees that the issue is complex, she says that the media is still giving too much airtime to climate change opponents.
It is a complex issue, and part of the problem, obviously, is 30-minute sound bites in news, you really need documentary programs to provide adequate coverage of the issue. But there are other problems, and the big one is giving equal time to groups who aren't representative of the science. The other problem is when we're looking at something like the proposed carbon trading system, the majority of people who will benefit in the future from us taking action now are not organised, and they're not putting out their message about how it will benefit them, whereas the minority of groups, particularly those who are carbon intensive and part of the fossil fuel industry, they're organised, they've got lots of money, and they are very effective at getting their view into the media. So again, you're getting a disproportionate reporting of those who will feel some pain from the necessary changes, whereas the vast majority of people who will benefit in the future from doing the things we need to do now are not organised and are not a coherent group able to have their views represented in the media.
And that was Dr. Carrie Harrison, lecturer for Communications and Environmental Studies at the University of Southern Queensland, speaking with Anna von Fern. And that's pretty much what we're trying to do here at the Third Degree. We basically want to see environmental stories covered properly with context and backgrounding, and basically giving the time to think the issues through. And ultimately, we have that luxury here at the Third Degree.
And also, some of us are involved in environmental activism networks as well, which does allow us the opportunity to take advantage of certain expertise which is overlooked by the mainstream media, as well as providing a space for self-reflection within the environment movement. So if you have any feedback or story ideas, let us know at climateradio@gmail.com.
Yes, and we've got a few event announcements now. There's the Climate Camp Fine Film Fundraiser, and that's tonight, actually showing Persepolis, which is a new French animation film about a young woman growing up in Iran. It was a winner of the Cannes or Cannes Jury Prize, depending on whether this is misspelt. And yeah, that's on tonight at 6:30, 16 Sloane Street, Newtown. And call Ollie for more information on 0422 331213. And it's also UNSW's Enviro Week this week. This afternoon, or sorry, at noon, is the Community Garden Field Trip. So if you're down with this, meet at the library lawn, which is on the upper campus, at noon, and everybody's going to head off together. They'll also be screening Sharkwater for the EnviroFlix launch at 5 o'clock in the Ritchie Theatre, which is mid-campus. And tomorrow, as part of co-ops, 9 o'clock in the morning, they've got the Food Co-op Crawl. So meet at Thoughtful Foods. And for more information, call Maria on 0409 350 428.
And next week, James and Libby will be here looking at ethical investments. Following up from a Corporate Watch report that has found that most ethical investment funds actually invest in uranium mining.
And once again, if you want to check out any of our sort of former programs and podcasts and all the various stuff that we've done, check out climateradio.blogspot.com.